Shannon, I don't believe your microphone is on.
Oh, there we go.
Okay. And legal counsel was going to send an attorney down just to make sure everything is good.
Okay, great. Right, thank you. Do we have the slide up? Is that part of the...
We have the slide deck.
They have the slide deck.
Okay, great.
But we can't until it comes out.
Perfect. I won't worry about it. Terrific. So the Housing Bureau produces, preserves, protects housing for Portland. We accomplish this by building and preserving quality affordable housing, creating new homeownership opportunities for vulnerable communities, and working to close the minority homeownership gap. We protect renters and homeowners from displacement, housing discrimination, and homelessness. We support programs that help low-income Portlanders find, rent, buy, retain, and repair their homes. And through the Joint Office of Homeless Services, the Bureau invests in programs to prevent homelessness and support economic stability. We are also jointly developing plans with the Joint Office to meet the city's goal for 2,000 homes for individuals and families requiring supportive housing. It looks like we have the slides up. Okay, thank you.
Great.
The Portland Housing Bureau is responsible for the management of several sources of public funds. Our three major sources of funds include tax increment financing, federal funds, and local sources, including a construction excise tax, inclusionary zoning fees, short-term rental revenue, and general fund resources. Since we were created in 2010, we have expanded from a predominantly geographically limited agency relying on tax increment funds to a bureau with a true citywide reach in rental development and homeownership. From 2015 to 17, we focused on securing and expanding additional programming and resources to provide greater housing affordability. Heading into the next fiscal year, the Housing Bureau will increase its focus on services for renters and landlords through the Office of Rental Services. In addition, we'll continue to increase the production of rental housing and homeownership units, as well as focusing on the successful implementation of the affordable housing bond. On the third slide you have before you is our production pipeline. Since the declaration of a housing emergency and the surge of resources in the last 3 years, we've been able to put an unprecedented amount of funds into affordable housing development. In 2017, we preserved and produced 656 units of affordable housing, exceeding our 500 unit a year annual goal. We're poised to exceed these goals in both 2018 and 19. We have 948 units that will be completed this year and another 978 units coming online next year. The Bureau will also continue to prioritize our fiscal stewardship over this large investment in our housing infrastructure. The Portland Housing Bond is an important part of our next year's work. Last year, the Housing Bureau and the Mayor's Office, in partnership with numerous community stakeholders, finalized a policy framework for the Housing Bond. Since the completion of that framework, we've begun to secure acquisitions and development opportunities. We've identified two new sites for development, one in Northeast and one in Southeast, which you'll see on the slide before you. The middle location is actually the Ellington, which was purchased in 2017, which is a 263-unit affordable housing complex. And then you'll also note that we have two new acquisitions in process in East Portland. One is a new building that is unoccupied, and the second is an existing building that will prioritize preventing displacement for those tenants. We've recently moved to quarterly dashboard reporting on our progress toward our annual goals. We believe this is a really important way to communicate with the public as to our progress and will help us measure success and be able to identify course corrections as needed with our programming. This slide represents the first two quarters of key performance indicators that we're tracking. I'd now like to move into some of our budget requests and proposed reductions. As all bureaus were required to submit a 5% proposed reduction, the Housing Bureau receives approximately, just for your reference, about $2.8 million in general fund resources. So we've proposed two places for a to reach that cut. The first is just over $30,000 from the director's office and business operations, and the second would be an additional cut of $110,000 to the East Portland Rental Rehabilitation Program. Our first major budget request is to realign funding for the previously mentioned East Portland Rental Rehabilitation Program for 1 year to determine if this program, as it was originally intended, is viable. The council funded funding to incent private market landlords to rehabilitate their units in exchange for a loan with a 10-year affordability period. In the last 2 years, despite our best efforts and taking on different strategies, we've been unable to secure participation from any private landlords. We believe this is primarily due to the current rental market and the reluctance of private owners to restrict their units even for a 10-year period. But we also believe this is exacerbated by the lack of mandatory rental inspections and enforcement to identify buildings with code violations. We would propose that we reprogram these funds for a one-year basis for home repair services for low-income seniors and disabled homeowners in East Portland. We think that this would help stabilize families and also improve the housing stock in East Portland. If we were to move this, if you were to support this request, we would either be able to repair homes, either 115, or if we took the cut, about 96 homes. We did also request funds for a citywide homeownership repair program. We believe that this is a critical way of helping stabilize seniors and individuals with disabilities stay in their homes. The second major portion of our budget request this year is for the rental services office. We are requesting both one-time and ongoing funds. Last year, the mayor increased the amount of funds available for legal education and fair housing. We would request to continue that $600,000 worth of funds this year. We would also be requesting approximately $200,000 to support two staff in the rental services office. This is to answer renter questions and landlord questions, and is even more important to us now that mandatory relocation assistance has passed as a permanent policy, which requires reporting by the landlords as well as the Bureau to process at least 12 different exemptions under the current policy. We also have a one-time request for rental services. The first is $200,000 to complete and bring online a rental registration system. We've been working in concert with OMF and BTS to plan for this rental registration system. We would also be requesting additional funding for culturally specific language legal services, as well as education and training services. These are both two key requests that we receive from our Renter Services Commission and the recently closed Mandatory Relocation Policy Commission that was meeting on the policy up until last month. Just to give you an idea of the Bureau's staffing versus funding, I just wanted to give you a little bit of background information on where we stand. We've had an unprecedented number of new resources added, and our staffing has remained relatively flat overall. The final piece of our budget request does not have a general fund impact, but would move staffing from limited term to permanent staffing. We believe that these programs we have in place now require staffing to be ongoing, and so there are four positions that we have requested: a housing program specialist, an administrative specialist, support for our preference policy, and management analyst. In addition, we've put in a placeholder request for two positions related to the housing bond. So that actually brings me to the end of my presentation. I wanted to make sure that this body had enough time to answer any, that I had enough time to answer any questions that, you may have.
Jump in.
Three questions. How many units do you estimate we are currently short at 0 to 60% of median family income?
Commissioner, we need approximately 24,000 units at 0 to 60, and we are looking for 6 to 8,000 between 60 and 80%, so 24,000.
And how did you get to that number? That number includes who?
We look at the available housing stock in the city of Portland, both in the regulated market and in the private market, and we compare that to the most recent census data that we have based on incomes of Portlanders, and we are looking for households to be no more burdened by housing costs than 30%. So it's an extrapolation of rental costs and the market.
And we're clear that those 24,000 units will likely not be built unless the city offers some combination of carrot and stick. Is that correct?
Yes, Commissioner.
Okay. Do you know what the current Section 8 success rate is in the city? That is, the percentage of tenants with Section 8 vouchers who are successful within the statutory time frame?
Commissioner, I would want to get back with you on that. The last time I checked, we were in the 70% success rate, but I'd want to get back with you at precise
And that's
number.
Consistent with what we're hearing, tight rental market, landlords being very selective, and so the value of the voucher becoming less, fewer vouchers being put into use, and that's money that we're leaving on the table. What's the current balance of the Housing Investment Fund?
I believe, Commissioner, we have just over $4 million presently in the Housing Investment Fund.
And is it fair to say that that is among our most flexible sources of funding?
Yes.
So, for example, if it's the council's desire to potentially increase revenues from other sources, put them in the HIF, the HIF can be used for many purposes, including providing services for permanent supportive housing?
Yes.
And my last question, although I think it should wait for the next. The Joint Office of Homeless Services, is the money that we put into the Joint Office essentially a pass-through through the Housing Bureau, or does it go directly from the city?
We manage the intergovernmental agreement for the city, so it goes through our budget, and we act as the fiscal agent for the city.
And just to be clear, I understand it's the mayor's intention this year for us to continue funding somewhere around the $26 million level. Is that correct?
I would look to Mayor Wheeler to answer.
So it's approximately $27 million. It is the current appropriation level plus 3% CPI on the administration at the office level.
Okay. And it's our intention in this budget to continue at that level?
That's my intention.
Good. Thank you very much.
Shannon, could we go over those the shortfall numbers again? I didn't quite catch. You said 24,000 at 0 to 60?
Yes.
I thought that that was our 0 to 30 number. No?
Matt, come to the mic, please.
Yeah, Matthew.
I'm just interested to see if these numbers have changed at all in the last couple of years.
So we pull a lot of
Name
those
for the record, please.
Oh,
sorry.
Matthew Schaubel with the Housing Bureau. We pull a lot of those numbers from CHAZ data, which has a little bit of a lag. And so in terms of people are talking about income increases in the most recent census data, and that probably won't be incorporated in for another year or so. But if you're looking at just the city of Portland and not Multnomah County, that might be why there's some discrepancy in the numbers that are floating around out there.
Yeah.
It's 24,000 at 60% and below for the city.
Okay.
It increases to 30,000 at 60 and below if you're looking at the entire county.
And then what about 60 to 120, I guess, because 120 is where rents, market rate rents become affordable. Do we have a number on that?
Well, for 60 to 80, it's, as Shannon said, between 6 and 8,000 for the city. I would need to get back.
That was the 6 to 8,000. Okay, that's the number that I missed. Okay. And then do we have a current housing wage for Portland? Like how much someone needs to earn to afford? I mean, it was around $23 an hour last year, I think.
I mean, it would be similar, maybe okay. To 23, 24. Rent increases haven't been as dramatic in the last year,
yeah.
And so you'd see the wage rate needed to be about the same.
Well, we keep hearing about how rents are coming down, so you would think that housing wage would be coming down.
I think you're seeing the flattening of
yeah.
rent rates on new construction,
yeah.
But older stock, you're still seeing increases.
Agreed. Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Fritz, yeah.
Yeah, on that note, I thought it was really interesting in the report of the City Budget Office that average rent increases slowed to 2%, which is less than the rate of inflation. So thank you very much for a very clear presentation and for all your work, and thank you to the City Budget Office for your analysis, which I pretty much agree with in its entirety. I do think we need to have the bigger picture discussion about what is the new normal on houseless services. I think we should be rewarding the Joint Office for having done more than they promised, which is a good thing. Obviously, we could keep putting money into that for the foreseeable future, and the question is how much, and particularly in relation to our rents starting to stabilise, I think that we need to look at the new normal in both of those. Why are you asking for more general fund resources rather than the fee-based rental inspection program as envisioned by Commissioner Fish's Quality Rental Housing work group?
Commissioner, at this point, we are looking at other options, both for fee-based, but we wanted to make sure that you had the full picture as to what the costs would be. If you choose to move forward with a fee-based system. But we are exploring that as well.
Yeah, I think making it fee-based, you know, I think $5 a month was the per unit was the fee that was talked about, and that would then have the option of providing a number of different services in addition to the inspections and all those things. So I would encourage you to look at that. Also, you've got the ongoing money for the Office of Rental Services at $1.15 million. It's also mentioned that we have money for the development incentive team, and I didn't see any analysis of what the development incentives team has been doing and plans to do.
So the development incentive team is a conglomeration of some of our former teams that were under different portions of the Bureau and including staff that's working on inclusionary housing. So they work on private market development incentives, inclusionary zoning, the HOLTI program, the multi program if that's to be renewed, and all of the SDC exemptions that come through, both in the private market and for our affordable housing providers. So they're essentially focused on that area. The new work is predominantly around inclusionary housing implementation.
And then just my last question. I realized after last week's preliminary, the first bureaus that went through, that we didn't have the equity analysis that we've had in past years in terms of how the Bureau's doing with hiring and retaining people of color and people with disabilities. Do you happen to know your numbers offhand?
I do not. I believe that we're finalizing those. I think we're actually doing quite well, but I would get you those numbers. I would defer to actually getting you hard numbers than trying to speak off the cuff.
Well, I just wanted to raise that, Mayor, because that's kind of de-emphasized in the budget process now, so maybe we need a different summary of how are we doing on our equity, particularly with regards to workforce hiring and retention. So I'd like to see that in the future. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I believe, Shannon, that we saw that data fairly recently.
We've had some data come out in the last few weeks, but off the top of my head, I would not want to report on that and be inaccurate.
Okay, fair enough. We'll get that to the commissioners.
When do you come forward again with your annual housing report?
We're looking at coming back to you next month.
And Will the report include a separate section on our new policy, our new goals around permanent supportive housing, and also our outcomes to date?
Commissioner, I think we will have essentially a placeholder for our work going forward. We have not completed the planning process yet for the joint office, but we will give you a snapshot of what our progress is in general with permanent supportive housing and what we put into the pipeline since then. But we have not completed planning with the joint office yet.
Okay, thank you.
And if I could make a recommendation on that front, Commissioner Fish, I would propose that be added to the annual performance measures. We'll have to find one more, though, so that it's even. But that is obviously going to continue to be of interest to the council now that we've set this goal of 2,000 units over 10 years. It would be nice to have a running total. So I will make sure that happens.
Yeah, so I had a couple of questions about the $24,000 and $68,000 numbers for people with a percentage of AMLI and the understock of housing. Is that's for the current shortage? I mean, is there any forecasting done based on immigration and other factors on what that might look like in 2 years or 5 years or anything like that?
We're planning under the Central City 235 plan and as well as our next comprehensive plan to have a need for an additional 10,000 units over the period of time. A lot of what happens with 0 to 30, the lowest of low incomes, though, is quite frankly really dependent upon federal levels of support, whether that be through voucher programs or even through Social Security or disability. Incomes at that level that we're looking at with 0 to 30 are predominantly folks that have disabilities or very, very low-income seniors. But we are projecting a need for another 10,000 units.
So you're projecting a need for 10,000 units in addition to the 24 plus 68 that are currently underserved?
Yes.
Okay. I had a question about you said that you were on the new pending bond-related expense in East Portland where you're prioritizing avoiding displacement. This is for the housing bond progress on the East Portland. There are a couple of new one that you said was going to be an acquisition, and I think the other you said you were working to prioritize avoiding displacement existing tenants?
Yes.
Okay. I my question just on that one was, is that a privately owned building that you're doing that work on?
Yes. I mean,
so if I'm the owner of that building and I know that the city is prioritizing avoiding displacement with no strong disincentives in place to avoid having them increase the cost of living there. Are you working with that owner to make sure that they keep rents affordable? Because if the city's going to be on the hook via the bond to cover the difference in price between what people can pay and what they're being charged, if there's no cap on what they're being charged, that I see a potential issue.
So the housing bond is used for capital. We cannot use it for services or paying rent differential. But what we are looking for are opportunities where housing is moving from a market affordable to market unaffordable, which is what we're seeing a lot in East Portland, which is displacing a lot of families. And we're actually planning on buying that building. So we would be moving that building that we're speaking of into permanent affordability and helping those tenants remain in East Portland.
Okay, so you're talking about buying the building?
Yes.
Okay, I didn't get that from your presentation.
Okay. Director Callahan, can I just go back for a moment to Section 8?
Certainly.
As everyone knows, Section 8 is the federal voucher program. It's the largest housing program in the state of Oregon. We're not really clear where it's going to end up in the president's budget or in whatever budget the Congress passes, although historically, voucher programs have done better than direct subsidies with some Republicans. But I'm concerned about the success rate that you said is now back into the, and potentially in the 70s. Mm-hmm. What that means is that more than a quarter of people who get a voucher after going through a laborious process are not able to successfully secure a tenancy. Now, when we last looked at this a number of years ago, we found out that things like market conditions, discrimination, and also the way the program was administered were barriers. Mm-hmm. So we've addressed those in some ways. We've tried to be responsive to landlords. Are you getting any feedback from the landlord community and from Home Forward as to what the specific barriers people are facing now?
Commissioner, I think it's primarily the barriers of affordable rents that they can find with those units. Home Forward and the city in partnership have done a number of different things, including a market rate adjustment, as you know, a few years ago. But the challenge, I think, is always finding units that people with a voucher can't afford.
Well, is it your view, in light of the numbers, that we should be more aggressive in looking to project-based Section 8 vouchers?
I think that can be a huge policy question for Home Forward and a huge fiscal impact. They have moved to doing more project-based over a period of years. They are supporting the housing bond with at least 400 units of rent support, which is key. But that said, I think that they and their board are trying to strike the right balance through housing choice and project-based vouchers. I don't know that I would have a definitive opinion at this moment.
I'd like to, if we can, at some point follow up on this, maybe the next time you come by to visit, because, again, once upon a time, with a lot of work, we got above 90% in terms of success rate.
Right.
And if we're in the 70s, it says we've got a lot of headwinds, and it means a lot of people who desperately need housing are unable to find a willing landlord and a successful tenancy, and that's discouraging, and that's also leaving a lot of money on the table. So thank you.
As several of you know, this is an area I'm greatly interested in. First of all, from East Portland standpoint, we want to thank you for increasing the amount this last year in spending in East Portland. We have some concerns about the cut for the rental rehab. We understand, because the outside forces, that program hasn't been overly successful, and understand putting it into home ownership right now, that seems like the right thing to do. I noticed in your report, in the CBO's report, the recommendation is in rental rehabilitation and home repair, but it's just mentioning home ownership with the CBO's recommendation and also expanding it outside of East Portland. East Portland's taken a lot of cuts. We were originally supposed to have $1.5 million going toward East Portland because of the underfunding in housing over time. So by expanding that, and this is not toward you, but more toward Andrew, it's actually increasing inequities. So that's just a statement I want to make. I have a question on the bond projects and the two you mentioned that are pending. What is the number of units, and what type of units? Are they family units, or what we consider family, two or more bedrooms, or less than?
There is a high number of family units. It would be more than 150 units that we're looking at in East Portland presently. One of them is an occupied building, as I mentioned, and the other is a building that is currently being developed but is unoccupied. And both of those units have more than 50% family size units, so two bedrooms or greater.
Okay. And you mentioned that there was a couple possible potential projects you were looking at for East Portland, because I'm really concerned. I was on the stakeholder groups, and we were looking at a significant amount of places being rehabbed. as part of it, and our focus was East Portland is considered low opportunity but high vulnerability. So the rehab would really be beneficial there. Mm-hmm. Of those projects, how many units are you talking about?
So out of the 150 I just mentioned, 100 of them would be rehabilitated buildings. We've had a number of different opportunities in East Portland that we've also been looking at over a period of time. But some of those we have not been successful in securing.
Okay. I had another question here. One of the things we were talking about, the rents leveling off or declining, not being as high, but as you stated, in East Portland, that's not the case. Being on the David Douglas School Board, we noticed that this year, where the prior year homelessness or houselessness from our statistics we gathered was 400 in March. This year it was over 400 in November, which indicates more displacement in our area. I've been an advocate for the city to look at our schools. Over a decade ago, PPS experienced rapid declining enrollments. They really were the barometer that gentrification was occurring. I'm seeing the same thing in East Portland. So what is the Housing Bureau doing to assist to prevent the displacement besides the small amount of units, because it is that's what we're seeing is displacement in East Portland?
Thank you, Frieda. First, I'd like to note that the decrease in rent that we're speaking of is actually at the very high end with the new units coming online. So it is not an overall decrease in rent that families who are living in Portland are experiencing, but more just, you know, when the average citywide unit is now going for a two-bedroom at $1,700, we're talking about that level of rent. We're not talking about, you know, folks who are living broadly in the city, but more of kind of the newer units coming online. They're seeing a lot more vacancies, et cetera. So I just wanted to clarify that, first of all. I think besides looking at the opportunities to build and develop and prevent displacement, I think some of the most important work we're doing has to do with the Office of Renter Services and the newer policies that council is passing, as well as providing legal education services, especially culturally specific and targeted legal education for folks in East Portland to help them retain their housing. People experience a fair amount of housing discrimination or failure to know their rights, and all of those things can keep families housed. Also, I think the rent support that you hear about, especially with some of the work that the Joint Office is doing, is helping keep and prevent displacement as much as we can. But there's definitely more we could do.
We've got a few minutes. So if you would indulge me for a second, could somebody just sort of share more information on the new rental registration system and the plans for that, and what the hope is that that'll come out of that? I gather that one of the things that we hope will come out of it is that there will be a more robust participation in a rental rehabilitation program in the future, because they'll need to and we'll know it. I would love to get more information on the vision for that.
I'll give you the broad vision, and certainly if anybody else wants to chime in, feel free to do so. There have been a lot of conversations about the state of the rental market over the course of the last couple of years here in the city. We all acknowledge there's been significant displacement, particularly at lower income levels. We live in a state that does not allow either rent stabilization or just cause eviction. So as a city council, we have been very aggressive in terms of putting forward other policies like the rental relocation model. One thing that we have heard both from the tenant side of the equation and the landlord side of the equation is that our city has an almost unique lack of quality data on the hydraulics of the rental market. And for example, we're talking now about where is the actual rent relief that we're all hearing about taking place, and we know that that is taking place at the top end of the market. But there are many other questions that we cannot answer due to the lack of a quality data system. And so the renter registration, the rental registration process simply asks that we create a mechanism by where rental units are registered and data is collected and disseminated with regard to that information that helps us build better informed policies around the rental market going forward. And I should say this is actually one of the less controversial aspects of the last year around housing and rental services. As I say, the quality data is something that's being asked for by both landlords and tenants as we make policy. I will go one step further and say my vision for this is that it becomes self-supporting. It is self-supporting in other jurisdictions around the country, and there are many, many, many jurisdictions that have a similar system. I don't know, Shannon, if you wanted to add to that, or Tom or anybody.
Sounds like a great idea. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. Commissioner Bailey.
So I'm not going to take a strong position on the cut package on rental rehabilitation, but I just want to assert that we need a stick. I've seen photos from our home inspectors, rental inspectors, and the conditions that some of our low-income tenants are living in are horrific and life-threatening. And I don't sympathize with these types of landlords at all. I don't care if they don't want to have to restrict their rents for 10 years in order to get funds to rehabilitate. And in fact, I don't think they should be allowed to raise their rent at all until they are meeting basic life safety standards. That is my suggested stick. And it's something that my office is pursuing, and we're hoping if it's feasible, because as we often find out, we are prohibited from doing common sense things at the state level. But if we're not prohibited, I would like the council to seriously, or the Bureau and the council to seriously consider that. No one should be profiting in this rental market who's putting people's health and lives at risk.
Very good. Thank you. Oh, sorry.
Do we have any time for another question?
We do. Yes, we have. We have at least 3 minutes.
Building on the condition of units question, Director Callahan, I want to thank you for your thoughtfulness so far in terms of the asset management piece of the units that we are acquiring and will hold in perpetuity, hopefully, for Portlanders. Could you talk a little bit with the group about if that thinking is evolving and what else any of us can be doing to help the Housing Bureau in terms of ensuring that those assets have the reserves they need and that they're kept up well so that any Portlander that moves into them in the next few years, we can assure that they have a good unit?
Sure. Thank you. So we have recently at the Bureau, with the approval of Council, established a intergovernmental agreement with our partner Home Forward, who is an expert in asset management of affordable housing. This was necessary, we felt, under the housing bond as we bring on more units into city ownership. Prior to the adoption of the housing bond, the city has actually only owned 2 apartment buildings. And we felt that professional assistance by way of Home Forward would help us manage those buildings quicker, more efficiently, and with expertise that we don't have in-house. We're also greatly appreciate the partnership with the Office of Management and Finance, and particularly the CFO's office, in helping us with looking at our asset management plans under the bond going forward. So I guess I'm looking to OMF to help us as well with that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Next up, the Joint Office of Homeless Services. Director Jolin, thank you for being here and welcome.
Why not?
Man, Commissioner Fish is feeling very territorial. I'm gonna move my arms now toward you.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning. Mayor, Commissioners, thank you for having me. I'm the Budget Advisor. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you.
There we go. So, again, for the record, I'm Mark Jolin. I'm the director of the Joint Office of Homeless Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to share with you a little bit. Even closer. Okay, it's very loud in my ears. A little bit about our budget proposal, and I have a few more slides than Director Callahan did. I will try to go through them quickly because I can see it's good to leave time for questions. And are we actually in presentation mode here? Doesn't look like it. Oh, is that the issue? All right. Is it? Okay. Well, does that mean you're going to have to manually advance it because it's a PDF? All right. So this is what I'm proposing to talk to you about today, and we'll just jump right over that. The Joint Office of Homeless Services, as most of you know, was formed about 18 months ago, a little more than 18 months ago now, to implement the Home for Everyone kind of shared community strategies around ending homelessness, as well as to do the work of getting the city and county general funds that are allocated to homelessness out into the community. So much of what guides our work is what guides a Home for Everyone, starting with this shared vision that no one should be homeless and everyone needs a safe and stable place to call home. Our budget prioritization process, again, starts with the core values that underlie all of the work of a Home for Everyone, and that is that we start by prioritizing our most vulnerable populations. We promote racial and ethnic justice. We use data-driven assessments and accountability to guide our investments. We engage and involve the community, and in particular, people with lived experience of homelessness throughout the process. And then we're always looking for opportunities to strengthen our system capacity and increase leverage opportunities. Because we are the creation of an intergovernmental agreement between the city and the county, our budget process is a little bit complicated. We go through the entirety of the county's budget process as well as the entirety of the city's budget process. This slide is an illustration of that. The only thing I really want to draw your attention to quickly here is the community engagement side of our budgeting process is in the orange boxes. So we use our Home for Everyone work groups as a starting point for discussion about what we prioritize in our community around addressing homelessness. And our coordinating board, which has about 34 appointed members. And as recommendations come forward, we bring them to the executive committee of A Home for Everyone as well. Commissioner Udaly and the mayor both sit on that committee. As we look at what we need to invest in terms of addressing homelessness, part of what we obviously have to take into consideration is the drivers of homelessness. And as you all know very well, the principal driver in our community of rates of homelessness comes down to the growing disparity between what it costs to afford housing in our community and what our lowest income residents have available to them to pay for rent. So here you see the SSI benefit right now. Someone who is severely and long-term disabled has a cash benefit coming to them of $750 a month maximum. And what you see on the right side, those right three bars, are the average rents from the Housing Bureau State of Housing Report for 2016 for studio, one-bedroom, and two-bedroom units. We have 21,000 people on SSI in Multnomah County. You see also the monthly average Social Security check as compared to rent levels and what remains or doesn't of anyone's income if they're trying to find housing in our market. I can tell you that estimates are that we have about 100,000 people over 65 in our community, and the AARP estimated that 3 out of 10 people over 65 in our community are living only on their Social Security benefit. So that gives you a sense of how many households we're talking about there. And then the final bar you see is the income from minimum wage if you're working full-time, not adjusted for taxes and what remains. So even in a studio apartment, if you are working full-time minimum wage, you only have $590 a month remaining to pay for everything other than your housing expenses. And of course, we know that all of these dynamics are particularly present and more so present for all of our communities of color. Beyond that, we, of course, look to our trend data on need. And one of the places we look there is what's going on under our point-in-time count. So between 2015 and 2017, some of the things that stood out for all of us, I think, one was that homelessness, despite our significant efforts in this community, rose by about 10% to 4,177 people, even though we saw our unsheltered population go down by 11.6%. As you all have heard, compared to other cities that are going through similar market forces, we're doing better, but we're still seeing the numbers of people on our streets rise that are experiencing homelessness rise. We saw the most pronounced increase in the chronic homeless population. It was up 24% to 1,290 individuals, and 71% of those individuals remain unsheltered. It's the highest rate we see in unsheltered population. Women were up 16% to 1,355 people. People with disabilities were up 16% to 2,527 of the people counted, so more than 50% of the folks who are homeless in our community are living with one or more disabilities. And we saw the number of people who've been homeless longer than 2 years climb from 23 to 32% of the total population. Finally, while the percentage of the population made up of communities of color fell slightly, it still was 37% of the overall homeless population. Communities of color continue to be significantly overrepresented in our homeless population. We don't, as we work on...
Commissioner Bailey.
I just have a quick question. You don't have a number for seniors broken out in this needs trends?
I don't, although there was a small uptick in the number of people over 55, but it wasn't dramatic. It was in this low single digit. So that is a trend,
yeah.
But it isn't yet the kind of dramatic trend we're seeing in some of the other parts.
Okay, thank you.
So we're looking at need data, and then, you know, we're understanding homelessness as a dynamic set of interventions. It's not one strategy, one approach that is going to help us drive down the number of people experiencing homelessness in our community. And this slide is really an illustration of sort of what our options are as a community when we think about our strategies. So if we have this person in the red red circle at the top in the prevention bucket, one way to keep them from becoming homeless or being homeless on our streets is to help them keep the housing that they have. That's obviously the best strategy we can take for them, and often financially that's the best investment. If that is not an option, we invest in diversion. We want to move that person from the permanent housing they're losing into another better housing situation directly without them ever having to become homeless. If neither of those two are an option for that person, they might find themselves on the street. And then still our priority is to first get them back into permanent housing. So we need to be investing in projects that get people from the streets directly back into permanent housing whenever possible. If that's not an option for somebody, then we want to make a shelter bed available for them. And as a community, you'll see we've invested a lot in additional shelter. But shelter doesn't end anybody's homelessness. And so with all those people who are in shelter, we also have to be investing in moving them from shelter into housing to free up those shelter beds for the people who are still outside so they get the shelter and to reduce the amount of homelessness in our community. For each population who we serve, then, we have a systematic set of investments that we need to make in prevention, in diversion, in housing placement, and in shelter. The two boxes that weren't on the previous slide that I want to make sure you see, we also have to invest in coordinated access and outreach. How do we get people access to the services that we have? How do we give them the information that they need? How do we help them get connected to services? And then we know people don't just need housing and rent assistance and housing placement support. They often need healthcare supports and employment supports. In the joint office, we're overseeing that work for our families and children, for youth up to age 25, for domestic violence survivors, and for adults, including singles, men and women, couples with disabilities, elderly folks, and veterans. And then finally, of course, we're looking at our data, and we're looking at our outcomes. We're setting goals for our outcomes. We have performance measures that I haven't got up here, all of them, but HUD requires us to have certain performance measures, but we often talk in terms of some core outcome measures that we report to the community on a regular basis. And those are essentially how many people are we preventing from becoming homeless, how many people are we helping move out of homelessness back into permanent housing, and for those, again, who we don't have that option for, how many folks are we providing emergency shelter to. And what you can see is over the last several years, we've set goals in each of these areas, and we've managed to exceed those goals. I'm going to keep moving quickly just because we'll run out of time otherwise, but I'm happy to come back to some of those specific outcome measures as I go through the budget presentation. But in total, our investments in this past year helped about 30,000 people with some level of support. You had over 8,000 people who were prevented from becoming homeless, almost 6,000 who were able to move back into permanent housing, and over 8,000 individuals who accessed shelter unduplicated. Sorry, I think I gave you too high a prevention number. The prevention number last year was 6,139. And as you can see, the trends are going up across the board. As we've made additional investments, we've seen the outcomes grow, as you would expect. So the budget that we've submitted is a total budget of about $61 million. It's a current service level budget. Through all of the work that we did with our community partners, the clear message was sustain the existing capacity. The need is growing. We know that. And of course, if there are additional resources available, we can use them. But let's start with maintaining the set of investments that we have committed to in our community. And that's $58.5 million of the total investments. And to be clear for you, that's not the city. So our budget is a combined budget. And what we've broken out for you in the bar graphs is the amount of money that is coming from city general fund, county general fund, and other sources. So you'll see that in this proposed budget, a little over $28 million is coming in city general fund. That's the orange bar there. This slide also shows how the investments are broken out. So for permanent housing, supportive housing, and housing placement, you're seeing about $31 million or 51% of our budget's there, and I'll come back to these in subsequent slides, and about 35% is going to shelter safety off the streets.
Before you move on, I thought that we started off being city and county, it's about the same.
No. When we formed the joint office, there was an existing differential in terms of what the city and the county were each investing in homeless services as they are in our office. And then you each added an equivalent amount over the top of that with those Home for Everyone investments of $10 million each. So there's always been a distinction. One of the pieces of work that our office doesn't do is the prevention side of the work. And I'll show you in a subsequent slide, but the prevention dollars that the county invests are at the Department of County Human Services. We've always been sort of unequal as a starting point, and then as we've added, we've tried to add equivalent over the years.
Thank you. On the slide, you have City of Gresham. Do they contribute?
The City of Gresham doesn't currently contribute general funds.
You just got the placement on the slide.
The placement, yeah. So let me move on. So I'll just call out here because it doesn't come out anywhere else. So our administration expense with this budget would be about 5% of our total budget. So 95% of the dollars that come into our office are going back out into the community to nonprofits that actually do the service delivery. So these are the big categories, and I want to be real clear that some of these numbers that are in the blue columns are really just illustrative of the kinds of services that we're buying and the scale. It is not comprehensive of everything that we're purchasing with the dollar amounts in these buckets. But system support, access, and coordination, this really is what I was talking about. It's like, how do people know about the services? How do we get people connected to services? We fund 211 Info. They take about 7,000 contacts a month from people seeking service. And you can see in this bar graph that in the most recent quarter in 2017, they received over 10,000 calls for housing-related services. This is also where we fund coordinated access. So when we have a scarce number of resources in any system, and we have a scarce number of resources in every system, we have to coordinate access to those to make sure that the folks who are most vulnerable are getting priority access to those limited resources. And so in our adult system, we introduced a new coordinated access process for access to permanent supportive housing. We did over 1,000 assessments already this year. We have coordinated access in our family system, in our youth system, and in our domestic violence system as well. Safety off the streets is the next, and this is, as I said, about 30% of our budget. It's $21 million that are going to run shelter. And again, this is shelter not just for singles, but for youth, domestic violence survivors, families, veterans. All told, we're funding about 1,370 year-round shelter beds for all of those populations, and in addition, about 595 winter shelter beds. With these resources, you can see here that last year an unduplicated 8,532 people accessed emergency shelter in our community. Here we do have one additional request for funding, a new funding ask. It's for $505,000 to allow us to enhance the services and infrastructure for our alternative shelters. These are places like Dignity Village, Kenton Women's Village, Right to Dream. Our single biggest investment area is in supportive housing and housing placement. It's $31 million. And again, this runs the range of rent assistance, housing case managers, helping people move into housing, and then also the work that it takes and the resources it takes to help people who are in housing stay housed. Last year, just on the placement side, that's not the retention number, we were able to help 4,889 people make the transition back into permanent housing, and 66% of those folks were people of color. We've launched a local long-term voucher program, which was part of the budget this past year, and we've got over 23 households already in on those long-term local vouchers, and we'll be fully leased up in the 45 placements very soon. And here we do have one additional ask. Actually, we have two. One is on the county side only, and it's a 24-month voucher for families who are our longest-term shelter stayers. As we're going through stabilizing the family system, this is a need we've identified. We have some families who've been in shelter many months, returned to shelter year after year, and while we have about 200 dedicated Section 8 vouchers for families in our system, we don't have enough, and this will allow us to move a good number of those families out. We've also asked,
How many more vouchers?
This would represent about 24-month vouchers is the request at $600,000. And then we've also asked for an adjustment in overall rent assistance of $350,000 split between the city and the county that would just allow us to ensure that we don't lose ground on the number of people we're able to place given the continued increases in rents for our lowest income households in the community. That affects about 175 households. And then finally, we put about $4.1 million into the budget for diversion and employment services. Diversion, as I mentioned, is a critical strategy to help people avoid becoming homeless in the first place. Here we're investing in diversion out of hospitals, diversion out of the criminal justice system, diversion at the door of shelters, and also diversion back into communities where someone has an identified housing option. Because of our family system situation on the county side, we did ask for another $370,000 to expand diversion. And then the employment investments have been really exceptional in terms of the outcomes that they achieved. We put this bar graph in for you because we made an investment last year in a combination of rent assistance and employment services. And what you see here are the outcomes. The difference for families in terms of the wage coming out of the program, what they were earning, if they had rent assistance that helped them stabilize in their housing versus if they didn't. And you can see that it's a difference on a per household basis of over $10,000 a year. In terms of our investment, the increased wages of those families by themselves